Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Reimagine the city, the office buildings, the apartments, the houses. How would they look different if we were trying to reduce our carbon footprint? My three guests today have done just that sort of reimagining, and their work may help us all figure out exactly how you go about creating a greener city. And I'm joined by Katie Swenson, Vice President of Design for Enterprise Community Partners, Jerry Hajar, Chair of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northeastern, and Mark Webster, Senior Engineer at Simpson, Gumperz, and Hager. Thanks to all of you for joining us. So last week, we talked to author Bill McKibben and Harvard's Dan Schrag about global warming. And I actually want to start our discussion today of the Green City with a comment that Dan Schrag made.
Even with all of these unusual events, including Hurricane Irene last summer and all of the strange weather over the last decade and the overall warming and the melting of the ice sheets and the disappearance of the Arctic ice cap, this year in the U.S., we've witnessed some weather events that make climate scientists like me really scratch our heads. We don't understand this system. And that's really, I think, a very important message, which is we are not just monkeying, we are profoundly altering a system that we don't understand.
Jerry Hajar, to what degree are buildings part of our carbon footprint? We've got cars, we've got houses. How much of our carbon actually comes out of buildings?
It's about 40% for construction and use of buildings. I've been saying that 40% of the materials that go through our culture are often going into construction, about 40% of the waste, about 40% of the energy, about 40% of the emissions are in the construction and use of buildings.
So you're telling me that of all the things we do in a day, consume food, drive, buy clothes, live in a house, that 40% of all this sort of waste that's created, the carbon waste, comes from the actual buildings that we're in?
Those are rough numbers, but yes, it's a large
component. That's a tremendous amount.
Yeah. So the construction, architecture, engineering industries have a huge place to help us address these issues.
And Mark Webster, so I know you've looked at a specific project. You and Jerry Hajar have worked on it together. The idea of almost building buildings like Legos so that they can be disassembled.
Sure. What we see now in most construction, commercial construction and residential construction, is that designers aren't really thinking too hard about what happens at the end of the life of the building. The systems that are being used are not typically reusable. There's a very common system used in commercial construction for, you know, office buildings, hospitals, that sort of thing, which involves using steel beams. It's a metal corrugated deck and then concrete cast on top of that metal deck to form the floor system. That system is really completely unreusable. It's a throwaway system. The best you can do is crush it up and maybe recycle the concrete into fill, which is really sort of a downcycling idea. It's not true recycling where you can take a material that's been used and create the same material again. The steel, it is true, you could melt that down and create new steel beams, so that's a little better. But really, from an environmental standpoint, the best thing we can do is reuse those materials.
What is the usual lifespan of an office building out there from the moment it's built to the moment that, you know, the wrecking ball comes for it?
Yeah. Well, you know, it varies tremendously, of course, but usually for design, we assume maybe a 60-year life. One study that was done in Minnesota actually showed that buildings were lasting a lot less than 60 years, which maybe on the average 35, 40 years, which makes the idea of reuse all that more important, because if you know the materials are not going to be in the building for that 70 years and they're just going to be recycled or thrown away at the end of the life, if that happens more immediately, that's more of an impact on the environment. A lot of the reasons that buildings get torn down is not so much that they've worn out, it's that they can't be adapted, they can't be reused, the neighborhood changes, that sort of thing.
Okay, so you can take each piece, put them together, and then at the end of the 50 or 60 years or however long, you can take it apart piece by piece instead of coming with the wrecking ball for it.
Correct. And this is the research that Jerry and I are going to be working on, which is going to test a system that I and some of my associates developed, which is a very similar idea to the system that I just described that's out there in most commercial buildings now. But instead of recycling the products, the materials in there at the end of life, you can unscrew the bolts, you can take planks off, you can take the steel beams out, and instead of melting the beams down and recycling them that way, you could store them, refabricate them, put them right into a new building. So if you can imagine the environmental impact, even of recycling a steel beam, where you have to ship it down to some plant, maybe in Arkansas or Texas, melt it down in an electric arc furnace, which uses a tremendous amount of electricity and energy, ship it back to a new job site, you know, maybe back up in Boston or whatever, is a lot more impact on the environment than just taking this piece out of the building, maybe refabricating it and putting it right into another building, maybe in the same town. So it's probably like we estimate maybe a 90% reduction in the environmental impact for that reuse.
Jerry Hajar, let me come to you on this. Okay, I'm a builder. I'm building a building. I understand that 50 or 60 years is not a real long time for a building to be around. Obviously, there's buildings that have been around for hundreds and thousands of years. But it's a pretty long time in the lifespan of my construction firm. So why would I care what somebody is going to do in 60 years with the building? Isn't it easier to just sort of slap things together, glue them in place instead of doing it in a way that, oh, in 60 years, somebody can come and unbolt everything and take it apart and reuse everything? What's the incentive?
Well, hopefully there'll be several incentives over time. Right now, it feels like it's easier to do as you said, but we hope to spur whole new industries here where perhaps there'll be some benefits to maybe selling some of these materials back at the end. But also the cost of sustainability, if you will, has not necessarily been built into our culture yet. And at some point as time goes on, I think increasingly it will. And then these types of strategies hopefully will become more commonplace because they have to be.
And I think Mark Webster touched on something interesting, which is that we think of recycling as so efficient, and that's really what we should all aim to do is recycle everything we have. But recycling in some ways can be really inefficient, much more inefficient than just reusing something.
Well, certainly recycling is a great improvement for our construction materials in general. We've been doing it now for a number of years. It's been effective. But the energy embodied in recycling is significant. And the whole prospect of being able to have reuse of and refabrication of materials, I think, is very promising. If you look, for example, at the way steel buildings are constructed now, there are steel supply centers that are local to regions, so they're already stockpiling new steel beams, new steel columns. We have a whole transportation network. We have a whole supply network that's really ready for refabrication and stockpiling of existing elements just as they are for new elements that are coming from the steel mills. And that's just using steel buildings as an example.
Katie Swenson, let me go to you on the issue of housing. And historically, when people have thought about green technologies migrating into housing, they've thought of often rich and famous people, people like Julia Louis-Dreyfus or Ed Begley Jr., people who could afford those technologies. Is that changing?
I think it already is changing. There is so much innovation in the affordable housing sector. I think perhaps because it's so mission-based. You are looking at the long-term value of a building. Most of the developers who are building do care, will own the properties, and do care about their life cycle over time. They care deeply. If they're the building owner, they care about energy bills. And if it's individually metered and their residents are paying their own electricity bills, we all pay the same amount for kilowatt per hour. But the impact on our overall household budget is disproportionately affects a low-income person. So there's a real mission in the affordable housing sector to make sure that we're building quality buildings that will last a long time, that will be energy efficient, and really serve their residents. There's also an incredible amount of sort of innovation in the sector. And, you know, I'm seeing some wonderful new modular projects and prefabricated construction, and others looking to find more efficiencies in the building technology systems so that we can build more housing, serve more people, and ultimately make better buildings.
Mark Webster, if you look back at the mid-40s and Bill Leavitt building Levittown, buying up these big tracts of land for mostly for veterans coming back from World War II, in some ways, he really revolutionized building. He said, look, we don't have to take forever to do this. We can do 30 houses in a day, you know, 15 before lunch, 15 after lunch. We'll just forget the basement. We'll just put down a concrete slab. Have we seen major innovations since then in sort of mass residential construction?
You know, in terms of single-family homes and two-family homes, really things haven't changed too much. The National Resources Defense Council came out with a very good publication several years ago advocating optimum value engineering, where you can actually use fewer sticks of wood in residential construction. We've seen some adoption of that. There's still some resistance to that. It's a very conservative industry, both on the design side and on the construction side. People think they know what they're doing. They don't want to change it. But, you know, we're making slow inroads. I think some more interesting ideas that we could look at are maybe not building everything out of wood. For instance, in Europe, most of the residences are built out of masonry. The trade-off there is you've got a larger environmental impact from the start because, you know, wood is a fairly low-impact material. However, you may have a longer life structure. You may actually have a structure that uses less energy over its life because of the massiveness of those materials can actually modulate the heating and cooling a little bit.
Let me play you a little clip of Stephen Chu, who's the Secretary of Energy, talking at the Nobel Laureate Symposium about a really, really simple choice that we all make in terms of our homes, which is what color the roof is.
If you replace all the building roofs today with white roofs, and you go to cement-style pavement instead of blacktop-style pavement, it would be a reflection of the sunlight back into space that would be the equivalent as if you took off all the automobiles of the world for 11 years. And guess what? It's about the same cost, white versus black. In fact, if the cars go to light-colored colors, or what we call smart colors that reflect in the infrared, you can actually reduce the size of the air conditioner in a car.
Jerry Hajar from Northeastern, how is it that we're not making these kinds of simple choices? When you hear him say the equivalent of taking every car in the world off the road for 11 years, that's mind-boggling.
This is about a cultural shift. And I would love to see it happen. You know, if you're working on a building project, working with architects, working with owners, working as a team, we can talk about aesthetics. We think this building is beautiful. But as soon as you start talking about sustainability, the calculator comes out and you start calculating cost. That's a cultural shift that's going to need to happen. It'll happen as we all embody the fact that green is beautiful.
Katie Swenson, is there a cultural shift going on? I think that's really interesting what Jerry said about if it's a little more money to put some copper on because it's an adornment and the person who's building or financing the house can afford it, they want it. But then if it's a question of green technology, it is often, it comes down to the bottom line.
We actually found that you could do a green communities building for a 2-3% increase in overall project cost. You have to be able to engage in a sort of rigorous early design process, of course, to be able to do that. But that the cost of making good decisions does not have to be a huge financial cost. But I think in general, you know, we just have to expect more of our buildings in every way. Yes, they have to absolutely be aesthetically pleasing. They have to work very well for the people who live in them and for the neighborhoods around them. White roofs are fantastic. And what about green roofs? Why not take the concept of black roof to white roof and then make it occupiable and, you know, a wonderful place to be? We have a new project in the Fordham Bedford neighborhood in the Northwest Bronx in New York, and it's a senior housing project in a very dense environment. And the landscape architect designed the most beautiful roof terrace that now is the social hub of that building. And so I think in general, we have to expect more. Buildings are a major investment. They're a major investment of capital now. And then we're going to not only use them for a long time, but have to face the reality of what happens when they're even past their natural use or their built use. So how do we expect more of buildings and make sure we're making the kinds of investments to build the kind of cities that we want to live in 100 years?
So take me to some of those green projects, these sort of big housing projects that you've worked on. And you mentioned before that green is not just how much energy they save. As you walk through that housing project, what is involved in making something green?
I couldn't have been more delighted than going to the opening of a project also in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, a project called Via Verde that was developed by Jonathan Rose Companies and designed by Richard Dattner and Grimshaw Architects. This project is over 200 units, And it is designed so that when you visit it, it's really this sort of beautiful place. You can walk into kind of a garden. There are roof terraces that children can play on. They have a robust gardening program there. They have a small orchard. They have all the kind of engaging physical amenities. Each unit is so beautifully designed, and each unit has, you know, cross ventilation and is a wonderful place to live. And then they've really made the most of the larger environment, even of the views and the way the building approaches the street. Now, it also has significant solar panels and the highest sort of engagement with the building technology in terms of its envelope and its energy use. But it also is just feels like an oasis in the city, a beautiful place to live.
Now, how do people who are moving in respond to a place that, you know, has a garden on the roof, that is oriented completely differently, deals with windows very differently, communal spaces differently? What kind of change is that for them? How do they react?
These well-designed environments are a critical piece of helping people rebuild their own identity and rebuild their lives. And they use arts and gardening and resident engagement and exercise programs and other social building skills. But it's in the context of a place where people are proud to be and feel like they're a part of something bigger, that they're contributing to a larger environmental agenda, and that their building is really a beautiful landmark in the city.
So it's thinking of building in a sort of bigger social context. Mark Webster, you're an engineer. You work with people every day who want to build buildings. I wonder how much sort of social pressure enters into this. I'm going to play a little clip from a publicity video on Starbucks' website, and they're talking about sort of how hard they're working to make sure that all of their new stores are LEED certified, which is the sort of standard of a green certification. So let's listen to that.
We're proud of this LEED initiative. It's really important to understand we're a values company, and this is a perfect moment in time to go towards environmentalism and sustainability in our construction.
The LEED certification system is a program administered by the U.S. Green Building Council, made up of architects, designers, and building officials.
Under the LEED program, everything in building our new stores gets evaluated, even the use of reclaimed materials.
It's a scientific program that really gives a robust look at the building performance, so you can tell how the building's operating, not just how it's built.
Mark Webster, is this just Starbucks, $4 coffee? They have a different cultural agenda, or is this kind of social pressure infiltrating a lot of different companies?
Well, fortunately, it is pretty wide-based now. And I think, you know, it's not only, you know, retail stores, but even commercial buildings, office buildings. They're finding that tenants, they want a green environment. You know, they may not know exactly what it means, but they know it's a good thing. They know they've heard about the benefits in terms of air quality, lowering absenteeism. So I think there is a larger social awareness now, which is a very positive thing in pushing forward the green building agenda. It's retail, it's commercial. I'd say the toughest ones are probably the developers who are going to quickly flip a building and sell it to another owner. But even there, if they've got that LEED certification, that's something that they can point to and say that even the future buyers, future tenants will say, yes, this building has some level of environmental performance, and we want to be in a building like that.
How good do you think we are on both the state and the national level at incentivizing green technology?
In our sector, it's been good to hear these quotes by Stephen Chu, and we've been very pleased to see the federal government come together through the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Energy, and the Department of Transportation to create an interdisciplinary platform to promote what they're calling sustainable communities. So I think at the federal level, that kind of larger interest in taking a more comprehensive approach is very exciting. I also think there's a lot of work to do to sort of be able to bring that up to speed. But I think the ideas are there, the concepts are there, and I hope to see that progress.
Katie Swenson, Vice President of Design at Enterprise Community Partners, Jerry Hajjard, Chair of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northeastern University, and Mark Webster, Senior Engineer at Simpson, Gumperz & Hager. Thank you so much for joining us this hour. And if you want to share this conversation, you can get our free podcast from iTunes or a link to it from our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can read more about our guests today and hear previous shows. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub. Join the crew, Bob and the gang have so much fun. Working together, they get the job done. Bob the Builder.